Democratic Senator Mark Begich has held one of Alaska's two U.S. Senate seats for the past 6 years. Now he's in a tight race to keep that position. I'm Lori Townsend. What can Senator Begich point to in his first term to help convince Alaskans he should get their vote in November? What does he have planned for the next term should he win his fight and retain his Senate position? What do you think he should focus on? Senator Mark Begich is our guest today as we discuss the November 4th election and what's at stake on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by the Historic Anchorage Hotel. A mix of historical architecture and modern technology offers banquet facilities with catering and bartenders. A boutique hotel in the heart of downtown. HistoricAnchorageHotel.com.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to GetCoveredAK.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. We are talking today with Senator Mark Begich. Alaskans before Senator Begich, have not sent a Democrat to D.C. since the late 70s. Mike Gravel was first elected in 1969, and he held that position until 1981 when Republican Frank Murkowski won the seat. Republicans have held both seats until Mr. Begich beat Ted Stevens in 2008, starting his term in 2009. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. How are you?
Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
As you're probably hearing on the campaign trail, Alaskans are growing weary of campaign rhetoric. It seems that there's no end to negative ads, but it doesn't seem that we're hearing enough about important current issues. Let's look at one of them facing the nation first, and then we'll talk about Alaska issues, Senator. Concern about the Islamic State of Israel in Syria, known as ISIS. You are against training and arming rebels. Give us a little bit of context about why you feel that way.
Absolutely. But first, thank you for having this show. This is part of the process, right? An hour-long conversation about what's important, not only nationally, internationally, locally. Phoners are going to have a chance to ask questions. This is what I love about campaigning, is that you have these interactions like this. But on top of that, I think the last 6 years, actually, I think everyone knows how I operate. I like to get out there, talk to people, hear what people have to say. I'm now in my, I did two town hall meetings this last couple nights, and I have many more ahead of me that I've planned and scheduled to talk to people about the issues they care about. The issue of ISIS, or whatever you want to call them, they're a terrorist organization. They like to pretend they're some country, and they're not. But I did not support the president's plan to fund the rebels. And the reason for that was very simple in my mind. You have multiple pieces to the equation. I supported the airstrikes because they're multinational, led by the Arab nations. But when it comes to putting combat troops on the ground, and let me make this very clear, we have U.S. citizens and other embassies and so forth within the region that we need to protect against ISIS, no question about that. But we don't need, in my opinion, to put combat troops back on the ground in an area that really the Arab states need to step up. The Arab countries need to step up to their responsibility. You know, we had this issue shoved into a budget bill. For us to have to vote for the budget bill in order to give $500 million, which is now going to be in the billions, to these rebels, which a year ago, these rebels were ISIS. Today, they're someone else, and who will they be a year from now, right? And that's a big concern. On top of that, 6-8 weeks before that, we were debating a veterans reform bill. And what was the complaint? We didn't have money. No money, no money. Can't help our veterans, which I disagree with. That is, our veterans served. We need to pay the bill of their service, and they earned it. They deserve it. But here we come to just do a half a billion, and billions more will be on the block. We had no problem just spending that, putting us more in the deficit spending. And I think it's a big mistake long term. Now, do we need to combat ISIS and be vigilant on making sure they obviously don't enter our country? Absolutely. But the Arab states need to step up to the plate, put their people on the ground in order to push back on ISIS. They all agree ISIS is bad. But the challenge is, They all have utilized ISIS for their own benefit. Turkey is using ISIS to take out the Kurds. You know, before it was Kuwaiti, very wealthy people and others from Qatar and others were funding ISIS to go after Syria's government. I mean, they all used ISIS as a parlay. Now what they have found out, they created a beast, a big one. And now they're all worried. Well, then step it up, put your troops on the ground and take them out. Why do they have to always come to us to clean up their messes? And then when we leave, they can't sustain it. Proven by Iraq, ran. The one group that's doing an enormous amount of work and they're being pounded every day, and that's the Kurds. They're fighting for their what they consider their homeland. We can disagree if that is or not, but they believe it and they're fighting for it. It's amazing to me, but we couldn't afford it. We don't know who these rebels are. I support the humanitarian aid and I support the airstrikes, but the Arab nations need to step up and put their combat troops on the ground.
Let's talk about the airstrikes. Most military strategists say that wars are not ever won strictly by airstrikes, that it does take boots on the ground to really be successful in military efforts. What beyond airstrikes do you think America's role should be here?
Well, first off, the airstrikes are fairly, I'm sure the people who are getting bombed believe they're intense, but they're not. They're limited. I've said from the get-go, and they actually did this about 2 weeks ago, that they should bomb the oil refineries and the oil wells that the ISIS is taking control of, because that's where their money is generated. Not just their portable refineries. That's where we just started to hit. Take out where the wells are. Burn them out, because the faster you do that, that shuts down their cash flow, which they utilize to fund their operations. That's the one thing we could do more aggressively. But again, the role that we should have there is, again, what we're doing now with airstrikes, humanitarian aid, protecting our assets and our people there. But we cannot keep fighting the ground game for these Arab nations that all agree ISIS is bad. So if they think it's bad, then step it up. All you have to do is watch CNN, for example, and you watch these very able-looking men watching from the hilltop the battle that's going on, that they've fled their country instead of stepping up and fighting for what's right. Millions have fled. Now, I understand families and children and so forth, very problematic, but these men that seem very able-bodied, I don't understand why they're not fighting for their homeland. Can you imagine if someone came into Alaska? They wouldn't even get close to us because we would fight for what we believe in. This is a big contrast to when we saw the president of Ukraine came to Congress. And he talked to us about a week before we took a break. And he acknowledged he has a democracy that's working. It has still corruption and other things, but he says he's moving forward and trying to do it, but they're fighting the insurgents there. But here's the one line he left with. He said, this is the president of Ukraine. He said, you don't have to build a democracy here. You just have to defend it. That's the difference. He's willing to defend his home country, and in Arab countries are not willing to step up. If they would, you'd hear about the ground troops.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. Our guest today is incumbent Senator Mark Begich. You can join our conversation. I see we've already got some callers on the line. 1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide. 1-800-478-8255. In the local area, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. Let's stay on Middle East issues just for a moment, and then we'll move closer to home.
Okay.
There was an article, and this might be something that you're not familiar with, I'm not sure, Senator, but there was an article in the Sunday New York Times about investigations into missing Iraqi cash that ended up in a Lebanon bunker. Billions of dollars seized from Iraqi accounts in the U.S., sent back to the country to help fund getting the new government started over there. But there's all these questions remaining about what happened to a lot of these billions. Mm-hmm. And an investigator who started under the Bush administration,
right,
Stuart Bowen, special investigator for investigating this alleged corruption in this cash situation, tried to get interest. The CIA doesn't seem interested in pursuing it. The Bush administration, even though they appointed him, wasn't interested in pursuing it. It doesn't sound as if there's much interest in the Obama administration. What are you hearing? You're on the Armed Services Committee. What has this come up before the committee? Is there interest in Congress in looking more deeply into what happened to this money?
Well, if you remember the visuals that we literally shipped over to Iraq, pallets.
Yes.
Not little suitcases, pallets of cash. Because this was our solution, right? Just throw money out there and hopefully it all just magically resolves itself.
It's like a setting for a James Bond movie.
It's actually amazing when you see those visuals. While we were doing that, we weren't being able to fund our veterans care because we didn't have money. I mean, it's really an amazing debate. So first, the IG, the internal government investigators, and I'm assuming that's where that article kind of had mentioned some of that, the IG reports, clearly identified waste, fraud, abuse in those wars, especially in Iraq and where that money went. There is some interest within Congress. I can tell you, I sit on another committee. I no longer sit on Armed Services. I moved over to Appropriations, which is a very important committee.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm on Homeland Security and Government Services, and we have a committee under that reviews has investigative powers. And there's been a couple of hearings on this because there is a grave concern. We may never be able to track all that money. But it also asks, it begs the question, what were we doing and who was in charge of this? And are we doing this right now in other countries that we may not be aware of because it's underneath the cloak of top secret activity? So there is investigations and activity by one of the committees that I participate in because this is, and I get, I'm trying to keep my calmness here. I'm trying because when I had the gentleman, the folks come in and tell me about the IG report, I was amazed how much money they could not track. And not only the money that was cash, but these construction projects that we did, that some of them never got finished. Or they were multiple, millions more than they were ever planned. This is why when we do this kind of crisis management, we jump in, like this $500 million we just gave, and I didn't vote for it, but to the rebels, that's going to be in the billions. And where's the tracking on that? And when we get back after the election, there is one thing that's going to happen, because we're going to have this discussion and debate of what our foreign policy is going to be in the Middle East, how we deal with the money issues like this. How do we deal with support or non-support? And what is the role of the U.S. long-term in the Middle East? Because trying to prop up these governments, like look at Iraq. We tried to prop them up, and then the first ability for them to defend their country, it collapsed. They ran to Baghdad and left all these pieces of equipment out there that ISIS picked up and now are using against us. Makes no sense. So there is some activity going on. You can rest assured when we get back, when we have the broader debate on the issue of our role in the Middle East, this will be a big part of it.
Thank you. Senator Mark Begich is our guest on Talk of Alaska today. We're going to go to the phones. We have Matthew in Anchorage who has a question about a questionnaire. Matthew?
About a questionnaire.
I was actually in the Dispatch News this weekend and reading through the Senate candidates, and I was thinking I can't be the only person that noticed Dan Sullivan didn't answer all the questions. The other candidates took the questionnaire seriously and answered the questions, but when Mr. Sullivan was specifically asked to name three bills he'd support, he didn't even name one, and I just was wondering what your take on that was.
Well, I love those questionnaires, because they are actually, they ask you questions, right, that are somewhat connected and somewhat not, and it's important that I think voters, as it's almost like a voter guide in a way, coming from us about what we're talking about, and I think the voter questionnaires, they also did me. They did Mark Fish, the Libertarian candidate, as well as another gentleman running. And all of us answered these questions. I read them all. I can tell Ted Genenousis, every question was about Anwar, no matter if you asked him whatever. I try to be detailed because I think it's important. People need to know. And we're very limited in this debate, in this campaign about debates and forums. And so it's very limited. I think Dan will have to answer for himself. I wish... it wasn't a complicated question. It was, what bills are you going to work on? And I thought, Safe Families and Village Act, for example, or Coast Guard reauthorization, there's bills we're working on, and you should be able to identify those.
We are going to take another caller, and this is actually a question that I wanted to get to about the Magnuson-Stevens Act, and this caller is from Kangiganuk. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. Elizabeth, good morning. Elizabeth? Good morning. We can barely hear you. Please speak up. And you had a question about Magnuson-Stevens Act?
Yes. This Magnuson-Stevens Act authorization form. I have a question about that. When are you going to help just fix CDQ for CVRF region?
Thank you very much for your question. This is on, we have CDQs underneath, and these are community development groups that develop fisheries throughout Alaska. There is a conflict between one of them. Coastal Villages believes they need additional expansion. Some of the other CDQs don't, because you got to take from one to make the other one whole in their mind. So we're having these discussions. I don't know if we'll be able to fully fix what they're going for or goal, but the delegation is not unified on this. This is one of the problems. And we're going to continue to work with the CDQ groups to figure out how to resolve this issue, because the most important thing, I chair the Fisheries and Coast Guard Committee. This is an important committee. It has the authorization power from Magnuson-Stevens Act, as well as the Coast Guard bills. And we need to spend the time to make sure Alaska is unified before we take the final step, which is try to get the bill passed. And the reason for that is if we're not unified, there are plenty in the lower 40 that would love to take some of our power that we have in the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And we got to be careful here. But the CDQs, there is a conflict there. It's one of the few things we're still trying to work out. When we get back after the session or after the election, my hope is that we'll figure out some way to move that forward. That may not be 100% for both sides, but we cannot do it if Alaska is divided. And right now we're divided on this. And the delegation has no uniformity on this. We're asking the CDQ groups to sit down and try to resolve this. At this point, they've been unable to. And but we need to make sure our family, and what I mean by that, the Alaska fish family, is all together here before we take the next step, which is to move the bill. We have two drafts. We're now in the final stage, and we're anxious. And if we don't accomplish this before the year's out, we're not going to go restart this whole thing up again. We will bring the bill immediately back up in the beginning of the session. We will not go through the whole committee process again, because we've done the work. And it's a good piece of legislation with some tweaks we still have to make on it.
Okay. We're going to take one more call, and then I'd like to get back to some questions that I have. But we'll hear now from Ross in Anchorage. Ross, you have a question about debt?
Yes, good morning. Morning, Senator. How are you today?
Good, very good. Thank you.
Good. You and I have met before last year. We talked about the Ketchikan. We talked about them becoming, you haven't been 2 years. Probably remember we talked about 30 minutes at the at a gala last year, Jewish gala.
Yes.
Here's my question to you. You know, when you were the mayor of Anchorage, it's been documented that you left with an $18 million deficit. And tracked to the, most of the damage there was done pro-unions in terms of contracts, which are showing up in terms of a well-publicized compensation listing by individuals, which was stunning with overtime and just the amount that were burdened here. You know, that translates into taxes, higher taxes. Please tell me, are you a high-spending progressive? Moreover, how do you justify getting another term when that kind of damage was left behind in the wake of you being mayor seeking the position you now hold?
Well, Ross, let me say this. First off, those ads that are running, they try to, you know, Koch brothers and others are spending millions to make this claim. Let me make it very clear. And also the lawyer that worked for the current Dan Sullivan mayor, he concocted that report and was proven wrong in several points. But let's put that aside for a second. When I became mayor in 2003, I was dealt a $33 million deficit. I didn't complain. I didn't blame. We got busy. Every year, by law, we're required to balance the budget, which we did every single year. We built a city that had built more roads than the last three mayors combined in 5 years. We built a convention center, museum, built fire stations, added almost 80 plus, almost 90 police officers to make our community safer, which also helped reduce overtime because of the staffing issues. I can go through the list of what we did to accomplish a great city to prepare itself for a recession that came, and we were able to sustain ourselves. This number they like to use, $17 million, was a paper loss because of the stock market that we all felt. The stock market dropped to 6,500. Today, as you know, it's 16,000 plus. And within about 6 months or so after that, lo and behold, the current mayor had a $20 million surplus. The services and the union contracts that you're referring to now, there's a pamphlet that's going around. Well, overtime is up because the police officers, there's a lot less of them. There's a lot less fire. And what he's done is he's starved these departments, and then people work overtime. That's not because of the contracts. And actually, our contracts had less than inflation every single year. So I understand what they're trying to do, make the claim. It's a false claim. Paper losses is not cash losses, and we made them up when the stock market recovered. That's the facts. Since I've been in the U.S. Senate, our deficit annually was $1.4 trillion when I came in 2009, left by people before, and now we have reduced that by 70%. We have cut some wasteful programs. We're reinvesting in infrastructure and education. So there's the connector. But we built a city that's a great city, and I'm proud of Anchorage. But that paper loss was just made up by the current administration, and the end result is they made it up and had a surplus by the end of the year because the market recovered. And that's a fact.
All right. Thank you, Ross, for that call. We're going to take – there's lots of people that are anxious to talk to you
Good.
Today, Senator Begich.
You know me. I love calls, so bring him on.
We're going to take a call from Willow now. Bill is in Willow and has a question about the voting process. Good morning, Bill.
Yes. Good morning, Senator. And, hey, I'm a big fan of your brother, Nick.
Oh, good.
Pulse.com. Excellent. But anyway, my question is I need enlightenment on the voting process in the Senate. And my question is, you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. My question is, without reading the legislation, due to the fact it was not written, how and where do you get your information to make an informed decision, and or do you just vote the party line?
No, the I'm not sure what you mean by when the bill's not available. The bills are available. They're post.
Well, according to Nancy Pelosi,
well,
people ask about the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
She says vote on it, and you can read it later.
Listen.
Correct me.
Listen, I can't answer for her, and I don't intend to, but let me tell you how it worked on the Senate side. That's the House. I can tell you how the Senate worked. That bill was available. Matter of fact, there was an amendment about 200 pages or so that was a long amendment with additional items in it. And, you know, we spent the time, the committee spent the time reviewing the bill as well as senators. Now, you know, if some didn't review it all, I will tell you, I went through that bill quite a bit along with my staff. Now, I can't recite every section, but I can tell you where Alaska benefited and what some of the things are that were important. And if you're asking if I go with the party, I can tell you they're not happy with my position on opposing the administration when it came to guns. I disagree with them on No Child Left Behind. When they tried to steal the F-16s out of Fairbanks, I opposed them. They didn't like my position on the National Petroleum Reserve, that now we're about to start drilling oil there starting next year, 16,000 barrels a day coming out of there, filling the pipeline. I can go kind of through that list, but I will always do, and people know me, I will go anywhere, talk to anyone to do what's right for Alaska, and I will work double time to make that happen. So if it's a Democrat, like I have a bill that I've sponsored with Rand Paul on auditing the feds, which I think is an important piece of legislation. I hate the FISA and Patriot Act and NSA, so I'm on legislation to straighten down NSA. But also, I voted against the Patriot Act three times despite the administration wanting it. So I vote what I think is right for Alaska at the end of the day. Matter of fact, Senator Murkowski and I, this year alone, have a voting record of 80% of the time voting together. No other split delegation in the United States Senate has that kind of voting record. And I'm, you know, that if Congress worked like that all the time, we'd get a lot more done in Congress. So, but I review the bills. I get briefings on bills that are coming to the floor. And sometimes I'll vote for them. Sometimes I don't think they're perfect, but I'm willing to support them because I know we'll work out issues as we move forward. And no bill is 100% like you want.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. Senator Mark Begich is our guest today. Senator, let's bring the issues back to Alaska a little bit here. You had a rally yesterday to unveil your plan called Women and Families Plan. Tell us a little bit about what the tenets of that are.
Well, first off, you know, it's an important part of the equation when you think about all the issues we're dealing with. Also, you know, just the elements of it, just right off the bat. First off, issues that are predominantly focused on women, but they focus on all of us. For example, raising the minimum wage on the national level, it touches more women than most. Ensuring that there is access to women's health care. Matter of fact, it's interesting, most of the debates and discussions I've been in, the people who ask about women's health care and protection of women's health care have been men. It's very interesting in the last 2 months, 3 months. But obviously with women, it's an important issue, the right to choose and decide your own decisions of what you do with your body, not letting the government interfere. when you look at equal pay. And this has been an issue. I just want to correct something here that's been out there. You know, for me, equal pay, I've supported legislation not once but twice in this regard to make sure that women get paid equal for the work they perform. And in my office, despite the Koch brother ads that they've been running, you know, we pay, or with our legislative aides, people who do all the work, women and men are almost exactly the same. There's not an inch in between them. They're paid almost exactly the same for the work they do, and that's important. So making sure we have equal pay for women is important. The other thing is, for small businesses, women have a harder time getting access to capital. That's statistically proven. So to create more micro lending possibilities out of the Small Business Administration, so women who want to start their small businesses have access to capital, low-cost capital. The other thing is student loans. This affects not only everybody, but it has, for households, it's a huge impact. And what we're finding is, again, for women who have high loan burden on student loans, they're unable to access potentially for a new home and other kind of credit. We have bills pending and ones that we're going to propose that lower the interest rate to 3.85% for new loans, but also refinancing of student loans, because some have large debts of private loans they've borrowed and public loans. This would combine them, lower the rate to about 4%. Freeing up cash for individuals, predominantly women fall in this category, would have been able to use those resources for growth in their family, new home, business, whatever it is. Those are some of the elements.
Thank you. Sticking on the theme of women, we'll take a caller from Anchorage now. Susan, good morning.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
You had a question about Hobby Lobby?
Yes, I do. I was wondering, Senator, if you could explain how the United States Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision affects the rights of Alaskans, particularly Alaska women.
Well, first off, you know, this is an area that my opponent, Dan Sullivan, and I disagree on. You know, he thinks the decision by the Supreme Court was a good decision. I believe it was a bad decision. What this decision says is, if your employer, for reasons, religious reasons or other reasons, believes that they don't want to provide or allow the insurance company who they've contracted with to provide preventive health, in this case birth control, they can deny it. Even though it's an insurance policy that they have contracted with the insurance company to provide, then they decide and start picking what in the insurance policy you should get and what you shouldn't get based on their personal beliefs. This is very dangerous. And it's not just, some people said, well, it's only four types of the 20 birth control methods. And I said, no, that was the first day ruling. The second day ruling, where they added their final decision, added all of the birth control issues, or all the birth control methods, would be able to be denied for women. I think it's a big mistake. I mean, what next? I mean, are they going to say, because they don't like blood transfusions, then you as an employee, we won't cover that? Or let's say you're working for someone that doesn't believe in medicines or healthcare like we have today, and says, well, you got insurance, but we're not going to allow these 5 or 10 things. That is not, the Supreme Court took something that was an old law and interpreted almost the reverse. The idea of the original law that they interpreted was to protect the employee from religious beliefs that would be imposed onto these employees. And now they've used it to figure it out to deny women health care coverage, and in this case, birth control, which I think is a huge mistake. I've sponsored a bill with Senator Murray to reverse that action, and I believe we got to build the votes to do that. But my opponent and I totally disagree on this. He thinks the law is just fine and birth control should be denied to women because an employer has a personal belief and decides to do that.
We are going to take a break here. And when we continue, we'll be talking with Senator Mark Begich and taking your calls to see what you think Congress should be focused on in this next term as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Nano Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Ready to quit smoking, using e-cigarettes or other tobacco? Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free, confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online, and now introducing Text to Quit. Text to Quit helps you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse, all from your mobile phone.
Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message is sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we have incumbent Senator Mark Begich on the program with us. The call-in number, if you're all over the state, anywhere in the state, is 1-800-478-8255, 800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. I would like to ask a few questions about the Violence Against Women Act. There is a bill being proposed. Your fix is called the Safe Families and Villages Act.
Yes.
It would expand tribal authority over domestic violence and similar cases, but does not confer criminal jurisdiction. How does this help? What do you see as this aiding the villages in rural Alaska?
You bet. Well, first off, the Violence Against Women Act was a very important piece of legislation. I supported it. I think it was really made a clear case of why we need to ensure that there's resources available to help women victims when it comes to domestic violence and sexual assault and these abuses that occur. And the law also in impacts rural Alaska or rural states around the country for Indian country, but it missed out in a lot of ways the way it was written, because there was a clause in there to not allow tribes in Alaska to participate in that law, which was a big problem. And Violence Against Women Act, which again was important for us to pass, I supported the fix, and I've drafted it, and now it's passed out of committee pending on the Senate floor, and it's the Safe Families and Village Act. It covers domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse, substance abuse. In other words, empowering tribes and local communities to figure out what's best for them and how to handle some of these cases. Because as you know, the amount of people incarcerated from the Alaskan Native community in Alaska is double the percentage of the population of the Alaskan Native community. The system is not working. And again, this is something where my opponent and I disagree on. I support this. The state has opposed it over and over again. When he was Attorney General, Dan Sullivan, he opposed it. And I don't understand why. Why would we not want to give an additional tool to our villages to help combat this unbelievable scourge that's all throughout our villages and our towns and our cities? Why would we not want to give them a tool to help the communities better address this issue? You know, I've seen time and time again when you have elders courts or elders and youth courts, community courts, wellness courts that are driven from the community, that they can turn people to the right direction. I was just up in Bethel at the Council Village President's meeting. Gentleman stood up and he just went on and on thanking me for introducing this bill, because he had someone who had a situation in his village. And his natural course of action would have been turn him over to the troopers and off he would go. Instead, he kind of implemented indirectly what my law that I'm trying to put forward would do. And he said the end result is this young man that could have been incarcerated and gone the wrong direction is now a very valuable part of the community, working for rehabilitation, but doing good things again, got him on the right track. And he thanked me over and over again, because this piece of legislation will impact our villages in a positive way. And I honestly do not understand why the state is opposed to it, why my opponent is opposed to it. We should empower our villages and our tribes to help combat this issue in multiple ways.
I want to get back to that issue about tribal authority in just a bit, but we've got callers stacking up on the line. So let's take a call from Seth in Fairbanks. Good morning, Seth.
Good morning, Lori. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This follows up, and thanks, Senator, for taking all of ours. This follows up a little bit on the Magnuson-Stephen Act question, Magnuson-Stephen Act. But I listened to the whole fisheries debate a couple weeks ago down in Kodiak, and I was just amazed. I'm a personal use fisherman up here in Fairbanks, and I don't do a lot of commercial fishing, but I still know how important it is in Alaska. And Dan Sullivan, during that debate, he just kept coming back to his Affordable Care Act talking points, his anti-federal talking points, big government talking points. But it's obvious he doesn't know this Alaskan issue that's, you know, important and such a big industry here in Alaska. Don't you think we need a senator who's going to be ready on issues like this on day one. Even you said we got some Magnuson-Stevens Act issues coming up right off the bat, and they're going to be trying to take away from Alaska.
Well, Seth, I'm biased. Of course I do. I want to come back, and as chair of the Coast Guard and Fisheries Committee, a powerful subcommittee that manages fisheries, the Arctic, atmosphere, Coast Guard, absolutely want to get back to Washington and fight for the Magnuson-Stevens Act to make sure, because you want an Alaskan at the head of that committee. Because the Alaskan head of that committee determines the outcome, and there's no way a new senator is going to be able to do that. As a current chair, I hold that position. But, you know, it's interesting, the Magnuson-Stevens, or the debate, which I love the debate. It was great. I'm glad it was out in the air across the state. You know, only in Alaska can you spend an hour debating fish and not enough time, right? It was originally supposed to be 2 hours, and I'm glad we had the debate. But I do find it, you know, here was a question that I thought was very interesting and telling. On Bristol Bay, drilling oil in Bristol Bay. We have seen that play before. The leases were let years ago. Then we had to go buy them back and get the oil companies out of there. Oil companies don't see this as a priority. But that was, a very good question. And if you saw that debate, I wanted to answer it, but I wasn't given the chance. It was given to Dan Sullivan, which he never answered it. So I decided to take one of my questions that I got to ask, to re-ask the question, because I thought it was such a simple answer. Both Senator Murkowski and I have already voted on the floor of the Senate to prohibit oil drilling in Bristol Bay. So it was a pretty simple answer, but he struggled with it. And fisheries is complex. I wish we would have had more time. We could have talked about bycatch, sports fishing impact, subsistence users. All that's part of the fisheries policy. So, you know, this is something that Alaska has been very fortunate to have someone on that committee almost every year since the day Ted Stevens was elected and during my time. So it's an important piece of legislation. The debate, I loved it. I wish we'd do more debates because I think people would see the contrast.
All right, we'll take another call now. Alex is in Anchorage. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning. Good morning, Senator Baggage.
Yes.
My question is going back to the Iraq perpetual war in the Middle East that we're involved in. My personal belief is that the war in Iraq was started for reasons of privatization of war. I'm wondering what your position is on the privatization of war in our recent history. It's been the largest privatization in wartime history. I'm wondering if there's something that you have an answer for, or if you have any thoughts on it.
That's a great question. You're right. We had a lot of what we call contracted services in these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, we remember the stories of Blackwater, and all, we can go through the list of these organizations that we've utilized in these battles. And the reality is the best people to fight our wars when we're ever engaged in them is our own American soldiers, men and women. Those are the people we want on the front lines. Those are the people we want defending our country, because they have one loyalty, and that's loyalty to the American people. These others are corporations that is very dangerous long term. It's one of the reasons why these wars that were stretched so thin and engaged in are very costly. Also, private contractors for each of their, quote, soldier is very expensive. That's one of the things that we have come to see after the Iraq and Afghanistan war. The best way when we're engaged in any conflicts is use our own people, in the sense of soldiers who work for the U.S. Army, the Marines, the Air Force, all the military establishment. But continuing to move more and more to contracting like we did, especially in Iraq and somewhat obviously in Afghanistan, but Iraq was the bigger one, is very problematic. So I agree with you. And it's one that we're watching very carefully if we ever get engaged. And that's what I'm very nervous about, what's going on in Syria and how we may fall into that and be back into the perpetual wars of the Middle East.
Senator Begich, let's talk briefly or for a moment about the problems with the National Guard in Alaska. That's been much on everyone's mind, much in the news. There is some legislation that's been proposed. You had requested Inspector General reports. They did not reveal the deeply troubling problems that we're seeing in the Office of Complex Investigation report. How frustrating is that, and what needs to happen to address this? There is some legislation being proposed, is that correct?
Yes, it's very frustrating because when I made that request, we were hearing complaints and concerns from the Guard. A lot of it at that point was fraud, abuse, equipment taken, things like that. And then we started hearing the next issue, which we all are aware of now, and that's harassment and so forth. We made the request, and because of the limitation of the way this Guard Bureau office operates, they were very limited. Because one of the rules is if you want an extensive, review, the governor has to request it, which seems ridiculous. If we know there's problems going on, and because the federal government is funding part of this, obviously, we should be able to go in there like the IG does or an internal audit. We should be able to do that. And so my legislation codifies this and makes it clear that if we see fraud, abuse, sexual harassment, sexual assault, issues of this nature, that the Guard Bureau will have the power to go in. Now, be careful here because the Guard is a state operation. So there's a very careful separation of state and federal government here. And I think there's a way to do it. We've crafted legislation to do that. But we need to make sure at the end of the day, the Guard Bureau in Washington, D.C.'s responsibility is not to the governor. It is to the people who are serving. And what's more amazing is this was not a new issue. This has been around as far back as 2011-12 when we started, and actually you heard someone recently say it's even further back. You know, the question, and I don't understand this, you know, when you think of this issue and the governor claiming that he just found out about it, and then, of course, some reports came out that maybe he knew a lot more. Matter of fact, we know he's met with folks because it's been in the paper many years ago on this issue. When you have chaplains come to see you, that's a pretty significant issue. And the other thing that's more disturbing is we've had three attorney generals during this time. The top law enforcement officer, in my case, Dan Sullivan, who's running against me, is one of the attorney generals, and they've had two others. Where were they in all this? Because part of the Bureau's responsibility is to make these reports and present them to the state. And some of those reports had some information in regards to use of equipment and so forth. Whatever happened? Why suddenly now this is all becoming public? And I know why, because people finally got fed up and pushed the envelope hard enough. I did a report, or the Guard Bureau did a report at my request. Senator Murkowski, a year and a half later, did the same thing, a different angle. And then now the governor, and the reality is, for them not to know what's going on, and the highest law enforcement officer, in this case the Attorney General, not engaged in this. I know when I was mayor, we had issues with some of our departments, but I didn't sit around and go, well, I don't have enough information, so I can't move forward. I went and got the information. I got my municipal attorney to say, if you need to get someone outside the system, you know, a retired judge, for example, or someone of that nature, go do it, because we need to get to the bottom of this, whatever it is. And if it's just accusations, we need to find out if they're true or not. I don't know what happened over the last few years. I can just tell you this piece of legislation that I'm proposing will clean it up and make sure that the Guard Bureau and the Guard men and women are protected in their job and workplace.
All right. We're going to we're all over the place today. So it's kind of a wild ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is definitely a smorgasbord of topics. We're going to take Judy in Anchorage has a question about Medicaid. Good morning, Judy.
Hi, thank you very much. Thank you, Senator Begich, and I'm glad to hear you think outsiders should be a special prosecutors should be hired when there's issues in the state government, and so I'm hoping that you would support one for Benghazi and some of the other issues that are going on federally, but that's not my question.
Okay.
My question is, I'm on Medicare.
Yes,
and
Medicare.
I don't think most people, until they reach the age of 65, realize that even though they are have a private insurance from retirement or something else, immediately Medicare becomes your number one medical coverage, and the others become secondary. My biggest problem is that, and I admit that we need to do something about the health care in our nation. I would really like for people to look at the model of the Mayo Clinics and those types, because I think they're excellent.
Yes.
But what I don't like is all of the stuff that seems to have nothing to do with anything. I don't think it took the number of pages. For example, something I found out that was that became effective January 6th of 2014 is that I had seen, I have been going to a long-term doctor for years. That doctor does not take Medicare. So in order to see me, that doctor must see me free. Okay, he cannot charge for services. I think that is outrageous, number one. Not only that, he was willing to do that, and that was fine, and he's done that because I'm a long-term customer for Medicare, I mean, from his office. But as of January 6th, I cannot go to that doctor. He is unable to order any tests on me at all. They will not be covered, even if the clinic I go to takes Medicare. That absolutely makes no sense to me whatsoever. Why would it matter if a medical doctor who has a license in the state of Alaska, whether or not he's on Medicare or not, cannot do any tests, he cannot order blood tests, x-rays, or anything. And so I guess I'd like to know why that would be a part of Obamacare. It started January 6th of this year. And it's things like that that make people dislike this law a lot. Thanks.
Well, no, great question. Thank you, Judy. But let me, I would like you, if you don't mind, I'd like you to contact our office here in Anchorage, because that doesn't sound right. I think that's a CMS. That's actually not part of the Obamacare law. I think that's a separate regulation they've put in separate from this. But I'd like to follow up. But second to this, Medicare, and you're right, it is become your primary when you're in retirement. If you're still working and you're eligible for Medicare, it comes secondary. The other thing on this is the Medicare healthcare program is a very good program. We need more doctors to accept Medicare, and the gentleman or the doctor that you have not accepting Medicare is a problem, because what we want to make sure is that doctor continues to accept Medicare, and we have some challenges here. We need to make sure the permanent doc fix, which ensures that reimbursement rates are adequate for our doctors, stays in place permanently. I've supported a bill to do that. I've also supported all the other extensions that have occurred since 2009 when I got elected, protecting doctors and making sure they have the reimbursement rates. Second to this, this is an area my opponent and I disagree on. He wants the groups that have supported him, he wants Medicare to turn into a voucher program or a coupon, basically. You get a coupon, you go get health care and hope that 5 years from now or 8 years from now the rate is low enough that you can afford it, because the coupon's not going to increase in value, but the costs for health care will, and you'll be stuck with this low-value program. And that's I totally disagree with that. It is better to focus on improving the ability for Medicare to deliver services. Some of the things that are important, Providence has done it, Wasilla has done it. And I can't remember who's just now purchasing the private doctor one out in South Anchorage, but all those are now taking Medicare patients and being somewhat successful in that and lowering costs. But in your specific one, I would be very anxious to find out, but I have a feeling it was a CMS regulation not related to the healthcare law. I'm just guessing this, but I would love to follow up. Make sure you contact our, I think she said she was from Anchorage, I don't know.
Mm-hmm,
but,
she is.
In our Anchorage office here at 258-9305, 258-9305, because if that's the case and the doctor wants to perform the care, we got to figure this out.
Thank you, Senator Begich, and to our callers, and we've got a lot more questions coming up. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be taking your comments and calls as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Talk of Alaska, our guest today is Senator Mark Begich. I'm going to read the question from someone who wrote in to talk@alaskapublic.org. This is from Richard. Richard is from Anchorage, and he says, Senator Begich, I appreciate your stand against drilling in Bristol Bay. The risk is too great. But what makes you think we can safely drill in the Arctic? Wouldn't a spill be vastly harder to deal with in the Chukchi Sea?
Great question. Let me, if I may, I need to make one correction. My eyes are getting older. Judy, the number actually is 271 571-5915. Otherwise, I just gave you my fax number, which I would not want you to just call the fax. Richard, first off, the issue in Bristol Bay is that you have a renewable resource there, fisheries, that is valuable, and ensuring that it does not harm the fisheries up there in Bristol Bay. That's why I don't support drilling in Bristol Bay. But in the Arctic, we have the biggest, if you ask the Coast Guard, the biggest concern they have is not the oil drilling or exploration, it's ships. And these are freighters, cruise ships, vessels that are moving up and down the Bering Strait or the Bering Straits and going up to the Arctic. This is what they're most concerned about, these ships running aground and leaking out the fuel that operates them. That's their biggest concern. The requirements we have on OCS development in the Arctic is much stricter than anywhere in this country. For example, at shorter distance, 150 feet or so, to drill down to the Arctic floor, we require a blowout valve on the floor as well as on the top. So in other words, these blowout valve protectors have a double protection versus down in the Gulf of Mexico. There's only one required. You also have to have a containment vessel on site. So if there's any issue, that they can be able to move that oil into that containment vessel. Third, you have to have an additional drilling rig within location in order to, if you have to do a relief well, that you can drill it. Again, down the Gulf, those two things were not required. On top of that, there is stricter regulation above and beyond what, again, goes down the Gulf of Mexico. And the requirements of working with the local communities on spill prevention is also stationed and located within the region. These levels are much stronger than anywhere. Now, remember, we're doing exploration right now. I think Shell will be successful in striking oil there, but the development will not occur for probably another 10-plus years of production. And a lot of technology is being developed, so they will go simultaneously as you move forward to development and producing even higher quality protection. The North Seas have been doing oil and gas exploration and development for many, many years. There's a lot of great knowledge we've gathered from them. But I believe at the end of the day, we can do the development in a safe manner as long as they meet the standards that we set. If they're meeting the Gulf standards down in the Gulf of Mexico, then we're going to have some problems. But that's not what they're achieving and what they're focused on.
I'm going to shift gears again because that's been kind of the hallmark of our show today.
Yeah, I love it.
I want to focus back on rural Alaska again and the Denali Commission. The 2015 budget request is about $14 million. In 2005 and 6, it was a high of $140 million. Mm-hmm. What does the future look like? It seems like the Denali Commission is at risk of being whittled away to nothing. And what will rural Alaska do without these funds coming to help with infrastructure?
Well, first off, the Denali Commission was never an authorized program, which was a problem. I don't know why they never authorized it to the degree that we needed it. And they earmarked it all the time. And earmarks are not allowable in the Senate or the House right now. And I support earmarks. I think it's important. It gives us congressional authority and a direction that we can hear from our local constituency, then respond to them. That amount has gone down. The delegation has a piece of legislation that is to reauthorize it. So we believe that will help move it forward. But in the meantime, what have I done to help change, protect against this, you might say? In a bill last year, the WERDA bill, the Water Resources Bill, which deals with the Corps of Engineers, we fixed a provision in there. It was an actual piece of language I put in there to add Alaska to one of small boat harbors. And again, Denali Commission used to help in that area. Now this permanent program exists in a bill that has to be reauthorized every few years. And what does this mean? $30 million, because I sit on the Appropriations Committee, $30 million of that national money that now is allocated to that program. Alaska got $22 million of it, and a chunk of it went to Petersburg and Sitka for their small boat harbors. Again, a permanent program that kind of substitute where the Denali Commission went. We also now have an Indian, under FCC, it's Indian tribal money for broadband technology, $50 million fund nationally, permanently in place. Alaska got $42 million of it. Most recently, when our clinics were being shortchanged, all our Alaska clinics throughout the Native communities, we now got two things completed in this. Again, Senator Murkowski and I sit on the Appropriations Committee. That's a rare thing to have both senators on the same committee of appropriations. We were able to get full funding for those now for the first time in years. But more importantly, we both also sit on Indian Affairs. There is money owed to these clinics for many, many years. I can't explain why the past delegations haven't been able to solve this. I know what I was able to do this last eight months. We've been gotten settlements paid to our clinics to the tune of $500 million of money owed. And last stat I'll give you, previous 6 years before I got elected, $35 billion coming into Alaska through many different ways, sources, grants, loans, funding. The last 6 years, $35 billion. So we're holding the same trend lines.
We're going to take one last call in these final minutes. Nick and Palmer, please quickly get to your question. Nick? Well, I guess Nick can't get to his question because he's apparently not there. Let's try Moose Pass. JJ in Moose Pass. Okay, well, that's all right. Thank you so much, Senator Begich, for being with us today. And I would like to just ask one more question about the fact that we're seeing historic low oil prices. The country may overtake Saudi Arabia in 2020, and fracking is expensive. Are we becoming victims of our own technology? We only have about a minute to.
Sure. You remember, historic lows were $7 a barrel. We suffered through that. So,
yeah. Four-year historic lows.
$89, $90 a barrel is
not
still
historic.
Not
lows.
Historic, so
no,
we
no,
should
sorry.
Be happy. But I think it's great that we're becoming our own. We're importing less from foreign countries that don't like us, or we are held at ransom for things they want from us. I think this is a good step. But we need to diversify and continue to diversify our energy sources, wind and solar and hydro. We're seeing that throughout Alaska, and I think that's an important piece. On top of that, I think it also helps our economy and also our country when those prices are lower. It hurts our state funding, but it helps our economy. Can you imagine consumers saving money because price of gasoline goes down? That's a good thing. So we should be striving for everything we can do to diversify our energy source, lower our dependency on foreign countries when it comes to oil and gas, and making sure we're producing our own. And if I can just, I know we're out of time almost here, but people want more information, they should go to my website, markbegich.com. I'd encourage people to do that. And this has just been a great opportunity. And as people know, being here, for example, I'll go anywhere, do anything in the sense of spending time with people, whatever time they want to talk about their issues, to make sure that Alaska's issues are heard loud and clear in Washington.
Well, thank you, Senator Begich. We did have a question about the Magnuson-Stevens Act. Any insight into when it might be reauthorized?
Yeah, I think, last time it took 5 years to reauthorize. And, I think we're going to be this fall, try to get it done. If not, we'll be back at it early next year.
All right. Thank you so much. Next week on Talk of Alaska, we'll have Governor Sean Parnell on Tuesday, and a second Talk of Alaska with challenger Bill Walker on Wednesday. Thanks to Dave Waldron, our engineer, and on the phones, Monica Goki, Josh Edge, and Connie Huff. I'm Laurie Townsend. We'll be back with you next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.